back to Embracing Your Mortality podcast with me, author Sue Brain. On the first day of the month, I'm posting an interview with someone who's passionate about helping all of us to live more consciously for a better world. And with so much chaos and change happening across the globe, I just believe we all need as much inspiration and hope as we possibly can get these days. And this is why I'm so delighted to welcome my April guest as Felicity Warner. Now, Felicity set up the Soul Midwives movement over 20 years ago and has trained numerous people to help soothe the dying process and to bring a kind of new dimension to how we care for everyone at the end of life. And Felicity has won many awards for her work and was named one of the most inspirational women of the year by the Daily Mail. So welcome, Felicity. I'm so delighted you can join me. I remember meeting you when you were just starting Soul Midwives, and I think we had lunch together in Bath. And what an amazing journey it's turned out to be for you, and just how you've touched so many people's lives. And I know your experience of your grandmother's death when you were 14 was a really defining moment in your life. And just, do you want us to say a bit for people who don't know your story, what happened for you?
Yes, gosh, Sue, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me. What a joy to be here with you. It really is. And gosh, I hope I live up to your description of me. I feel I'm sort of blushing and sort of slightly wriggling in my seat, but it's so, so great to be here. So yes, my adult life has been very flavoured by events that happened early on that really woke me up into the reality of death and dying, really, at a very early age. So I was an only child of quite maverick parents who divorced when I was age six. And I went to live with my wonderful grandma in Cornwall. She was quite bohemian in her way. And we lived a glorious life living in a ramshackle old house by the sea. And we had hardly any money, but we had a wonderful life. She ate and drank enormous quantities, especially gin, and also smoked like a chimney. And trouble happened when she developed this hacking cough, and it was discovered to be lung cancer. So for the very last year of her life, I began to do more to look after her, and she began to do a lot less until the eventual happened and she died of lung cancer. And I went to see her the evening that she died, because she'd been taken into hospital for 6 weeks prior to that. And I was just so shocked by what I saw. Physically, she'd diminished. She'd been a big, larger-than-life lady with enormous bosoms and a deep, throaty laugh. But she was like a tiny little monkey, very thin and almost unrecognisable. And her breathing was very laboured. She was in a hospital bed in a grim, grim room, very sterile, with a strip light across the top of the bed and very harsh lighting. There was nothing friendly, nothing soft. And she sort of looked at me just for a second. She just came out of into and she woke up for a minute and kind of gave me this look as if to say, I'm really sorry that this has come to this. And I think at that moment, you know, seeds are sown. And I really thought, how on earth did we get from our lovely cozy house with the cats everywhere and food being cooked to this horrific environment, which was just, I wouldn't have sent my cat there to die. You know, it was horrible. So even at that early age, age 14, with all the sort of ideas you have at that time of changing the world, I thought, one day when I'm big, when I'm grown up, I'm going to do something to help people everywhere to die better. And so really, that was the genesis. That was the beginning of Soul Midwives.
Wow, what a gift she gave you, but what a painful experience for you.
It was very painful because she was all I had. She was mother and father. But she gave me another gift, which I haven't spoken about quite as much, but I do more so. And that was, I was taken home after seeing her, and I knew that was the last time I would see her. And the lovely people I was staying with ran me a hot bath and gave me hot milk. And I remember crying in the bath, thinking, oh my God, what's going to happen to me? Where am I going to live? I'm an orphan. It was a horrible feeling. And then suddenly, this extraordinary sensation came over me. I felt filled with love, filled with grace, filled with a kind of liberated, expansive feeling. And I noted it, and I felt 1,000 miles high and very strong. And I felt that really all would be well. The next day, my father came to see me and he said, Granny died at 10 o'clock last night. And I knew that was when I had this incredible feeling. And nowadays, that might be called a shared death experience. I was there and I was so tuned in to her that I felt that liberation that she felt when she left her body, which was full of disease, full of pain, and I felt how it felt to not be in that body anymore. Now, that subsequently has been an incredible gift in my own teaching to others, because I just knew then that death was not what we were all told it was. There was a better story at the end than we realized at the time.
Death, I mean, it can be such a teacher. I think it's a teacher anyway, whether somebody has a difficult death or an easier death. But, there is a teaching, or for me, I always feel that no matter what happens, some form of higher love comes present, whether that's an experience like you had, or, it's the determination to sit with somebody who's having a very stressful death, because it's a huge thing. It's a huge ask of anyone to witness somebody struggling to do with their death. And I believe, and I just wondered where you were with this, that's the presence of higher love saying, it's okay, just be there.
I
And I wondered
do.
if you'd had that, those kind of experiences as well with the people you've been working with.
I do, Sue, and I've thought about this long, and I've thought about it hard, and I've thought about it really analytically as well, in some ways. And what I really feel is that when somebody is dying, and when we're close to them, it doesn't even have to be emotionally close. It can be as an observer and carer, as I so often am as a soul midwife. I do feel that there is almost an expanded field that is created in the dying room, that energies are at play. They come in that we're not usually perhaps aware of. They may be magnified. And I've certainly felt so often this overpowering sense of love and peace and grace infuse the whole room where this is happening. And I love the way, in being a soul midwife, that I can hold that space for others sometimes, so that despite the grief that they may be feeling and the fear they may be feeling, that could be the loved ones or the dying one, despite that, I'm able to somehow almost explain to them that this wonderful awareness so often comes at end of life, that we do connect with that wonderful sense of love that seems to come from a higher place.
Yeah, I was talking to a friend of mine recently about the whole concept of what death is, and good death, bad death, and all of the sort of the tension between those two. And she works with people. She support her job is supporting people with stage four cancer, but she'd never been with somebody who died before. And she was sitting beside her father, who had, in her words, a terrible death. And that really confused her, because her work had been very much working with, well, how do we support people better than dying? But she couldn't do it for her father. And th there was a gift in it for her, obviously, which I'll talk to you about in a minute. But in the short term, it was sitting there. She kind of it made her sort of feel totally inadequate. She felt because she felt she should have known, because she'd been supporting people with stage four cancer. The doctor did not describe to her what was going to happen. So she was totally unprepared for her father. He actually died literally drowning in his own secretions. So she didn't know about the sound, the smell in the room, or anything. She was totally unprepared. She's in her 50s, you know, and it's this lack of education, this lack of support that's still happening. And I just find that really sad that we've been banging on about death and dying for how many years? And it's still like this. I know some people, because of the work you've been doing, we are changing our relationship with death and dying. But I just wanted you to run that past you and just to see how you want to respond to that.
Yes, gosh, there's a lot to unpick in what you've just said, Sue. I hear this a lot at the moment, that people are shocked when they've been sitting with someone who's dying, that they haven't realized that the person is dying. So they haven't been given that heads up from the doctors that actually this is actually happening at the moment. And it has been such a shock to them that they weren't prepared and that nobody just sort of explained. And I find that really shocking and really upsetting, because, you know, you and I have both done this. We've been able to slip into a room quietly where there is a death and there are relatives sitting there, and just very quietly, but very, very simply, without making a big fuss about it, just to explain in very simple language what the noises are that they're hearing, what the things are that they might be seeing, but that all of that is natural, and in all likelihood the person dying actually isn't suffering throughout those sensations. Now, I think it's really difficult, and I think this is hard because you describe a daughter sitting with a parent. Now, immediately I know the dynamics of that are quite difficult, and we know, however much we know theoretically about death and dying, we know if it's someone close to us, we are in a different environment because it's hitting us on a heart level and we're responding and perhaps differently. So I always in the back of my mind know that there are phases of dying. The first phase characteristically being chaos, you know, when somebody hears that they've just been diagnosed with stage four cancer, they'll be in chaos. Then later on in the journey, there tends to be surrender, knowing that you can't fight this anymore, but you're slipping into it. And that's a good moment. That's a place of acceptance. But relating to what you've just been talking about, one of the things a lot of people miss is that final stage, which is transcendence. Now, they're missing it because they're sitting at the bedside with their own grief overshadowing the experience of perhaps the dying person. And so often, just before death happens, there is this shift of energy into a transcendent uplift. And the person sitting at the bedside is unaware of it because they're so focused in on their own pain and agony. So again, it's such a shame that we don't talk about these psycho-spiritual experiences as well as physical, because I think it would be so helpful to people to understand that process going on.
That's really interesting what you're saying, because I'm thinking about my mum, sitting with my mum, who had a terrible death. And another, you know, it was a huge teaching for me because of it. And I did not witness any transcendent moment. She just suffered until the end. And then at some point, I think it got so uncomfortable for her, her body or spirit just went, I can't do this anymore. And she died. And I've heard lots of stories of people having those transcendent moments. So do you believe they happen to everyone? Or do you believe that some people know they don't?
Oh, it's so hard to say, isn't it? I think they do happen to everybody, but I think it might be, you know, we're talking about time here. And when we're talking about spiritual awareness or things, time doesn't really help us very much. I think it can be a split second of awareness of something bigger than the pain and the suffering will come in. But whether or not it's expressed physically or for others to see, I think it often isn't.
I'm just wondering, as we're speaking, I'm just thinking about that transcendent moment. Maybe that's the moment that, you know, people take a long time to die. They can take a very long time to die. And then there's this moment when something tips, and then the actual dying process is very quick. It's under a minute, isn't it? They start breathing themselves out of their body.
Absolutely.
And maybe that's that ultimate release or letting go, is that they suddenly tip and they're gone.
I think so. It's really, really hard to know, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I have a hunch that it is that very final. I love what you just said about them breathing themselves out of their body. Because for me, you know, watching someone die is very much like watching someone in labour. I think we really labour in our dying.
Yes.
And you so often feel prompted to say, "You are doing so well."
Wouldn't that be great to change that? Oh my God, they're dying. Help. To, oh, you are doing so. Another push.
Yeah, another push. You're nearly there.
Nearly there.
Yeah. Well, I so often find myself doing that. And I did sit at the bedside of someone once and her son had come in and I was saying to him, "Your mum's doing brilliantly." And he looked at me in this absolutely sort of shocked horror way of, "What are you saying?" You know, it seems so bizarre to him, but it just felt like, you know, she was enduring a battle, but she was nearly there and she was doing brilliantly.
I think it's just that shift to know that there is a release coming, however difficult and painful it is to witness the person struggling. And for me, my mum wasn't in physical pain. She was in existential pain.
Oh, well, just as bad.
Yeah, which is, and I think that was causing her to just the distress. And I'm very conscious of, you know, in the old days, you would unburden your soul to the priest or whatever you believe about religion, but that's what would be part of the dying process. They'd come and give you extreme unction, do the forehead. Have you got anything troubling you? Shut the door. It was all completely confidential, and they were able to unburden their soul. And I would love to see that as a necessary, important part of the dying process coming back. And I think there was one death doula that I interviewed for one of the books I wrote, The D Word. And she said, "We nurses are the new priests at the bedside because they aren't there anymore. And we're the ones they're telling this stuff to." And I just wondered if you wanted to say something more about that.
Oh, it's a really big part of our role as soul midwives, certainly. You know, we are that neutral person. We don't, they can say anything to us, and they do. My goodness. Deathbed confessions are a very real part of the work. And we are trained to it, to expect that, to know how to witness that, to know how to acknowledge that, and to enable that to be released. So certainly, I think there's a really important role for that in allowing those sort of psychospiritual obstacles to be released easily. So it's really important.
Yeah, I think that a lot more needs to be spoken about the importance of the release of the soul.
Yes.
You know, because
definitely,
you know, you don't want to be taking that with you when you go. You want to leave it behind.
Well, do you know, I think that is a really important essential in the art of dying. And dying well is an art. There is an art to it. And I think if we can encourage people and inspire people to release things that soul wounds, worries, regrets that have hampered them in life, because you don't want to take that with you. Let it all go before you actually go. And it's
I
very
know that
cathartic.
you're beginning to change your route into working with oils and herbs to do with helping people during the dying process. And I'm so curious about that. Would you say some more about what's happening for you around that?
Yes. Well, I've been attached to a very ancient way of working with sacred oils since I was 15. So it's an awfully long time ago. And the tradition that I belong to works with certain oils to really help prepare people spiritually to leave their bodies and to leave life. So there, it's a very small repertoire. And one of the oils that we work with is spikenard, which is the oil that was used by Mary Magdalene before the crucifixion. She was well known for anointing with and pouring this oil all over Jesus's feet, wiping his feet with her hair. So that oil actually is still used by us, especially for what we were just talking about, for enabling people to unburden, to drop their burdens before they finally go. So I'm working a lot with these oils to help people who are in the dying stage for looking at soul wounds, for bringing them healing if they have inner sorrow, if they have regrets about things. And they are so potent, these oils. And they belong to a very ancient tradition. So they have proved their potency over thousands and thousands of years. And I think the time for them to come and have a renaissance in end-of-life care is very, very much now. It's very present.
If somebody needed to have just one oil that they could take in and they don't know anything about oils or soul releases or anything else, anything like that, what oil would you say they could burn in a room when somebody's dying or gently massage their hand or whatever it is? What one oil that you feel like that would help?
Okay, the one oil that would work for so many different scenarios would be rose. And rose has an affinity with the heart, it has an affinity with the divine feminine, with making someone feel very safe and very loved and very secure. So of all the oils, if you were only to buy one, just have that. And actually, we don't use burners in this tradition. We put a little bit of the oil on our hands, just a tiny bit, and then we'll hold the hand of the person who's dying, and that will be enough to do the work that it's going to do.
It all these ancient traditions seem to be coming back into our consciousness. I think they're kind of sitting in the zeitgeist. I feel like, astrology is sitting in the zeitgeist, and that's very linked to do with herbal medicine and the use of oils and things like that. And it just feels like there's a higher consciousness at work now, which is, if we tap into it, enables us to do life and death better. And I just wondered what you thought about that.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I mean, soul midwives use a raft of therapeutic devices, and so many of them are from ancient times. And they're so obvious and so simple. There's no rocket science in them. So using our voice to sing or to soothe, using our hands to hold the hand of another or to very gently massage, using breathing techniques, again, very old. Think of yoga and breathing techniques. We can really help calm someone down with breathing techniques, or help them if they have agitated breathing. Using sound, beautiful music, beautiful oils. All these things are ancient, but we've kind of brought them up to date. And I think you're right about there's a zeitgeist sort of thing out there with all these things that are ready to come in and work in a very dynamic way within clinical settings. And I think That's the big thing. We need to make this bridge between the old and the old wisdom and bridge it right into up-to-date, cutting-edge clinical environments.
Yeah, and how do you feel that the clinical environment is welcoming this? Do you feel there has been a shift? I know the hospices are doing a lot, but I'm just about, you know, the majority of us die in hospital, and I just wondered what your experience of that in hospitals are.
Well, there is awareness growing, but I would say there's a long way to go, sadly. All we can do is keep on banging on about it and saying this stuff works and it makes such a difference. Tiny things can make such an enormous difference when people are dying. And these things are pretty simple to use. So if we could teach all the hospital people how to do some of this, then we would really be helping to crack this and make a better environment.
I mean, you've been at the cutting edge of changing our relationship with death and dying for the 25 years now, haven't you?
Yeah.
Just how do you see it shifting, and what do you see in the future? How would you like to see the future unfold around all of this?
Oh, well, if I had a magic wand and a real wish list for this, I would create beautiful environments for people to die in. I like to almost think of sort of Roman temples with water running and beautiful sound and beautiful things. I think if we could give people real love and real presence and real beauty at end of life, that would be something to really aspire to. And an understanding of the fact that we are not just physical beings in physical bodies dying, that we are made up of mind, body, spirit, and all that needs to be embraced when we're supporting people who are dying. So in the future, I would like to think we have a great many more soul therapists, if you like, working with the dying and really connecting with them deeply, as well as really good symptom control and really good pain intervention.
Yeah, that's essential.
We need that too. The two things all go together.
You need the clinical and you need the soul.
You do.
Working together as a pair.
Totally.
Yeah. So you've seen a lot of people die. You've been present in so many situations. What do you think happens as we die and move across?
Yeah, what do I see? So I see the cessation of life. I see people cocooning in those last few hours of life. I then am very conscious that when the last breath is taken and the heart stops beating, that is not the end of the story. There is a whole process that is beginning as that happens. And
what
I
do you
think
mean by that?
Well, so I'm talking really energetically now, looking at the energy of the person. And I see two very distinct energies leaving the body after clinical death. So I see an energy which I would call spirit, which is very much to do with who that person was in this lifetime, to do with their personality, and it's an ephemeral energy which is just going to drift off and leave. But I also see another energy, a much slower energy, an eternal energy, which I'd call soul energy, which goes on and on and on its infinite journey. And after death, it takes between maybe an hour and maybe around 3 days. These two energies will unbind. I call it the unbinding from the body. They will leave, and that takes as long as it's going to take, and it's a very sacred process. So again, a soul midwife will be trained to observe that and create sacred space around that person who has died to enable the unbinding. And then we also teach that when somebody has just died, you should explain to them that they are now dead and no longer in their body. This is a very ancient Tibetan Buddhist practice, but it's good manners to tell somebody, because sometimes people are a little bit confused. They don't really know. And then to really invite them to go towards the light and to know that there are loving beings who are there to take them on towards the light and to whatever happens next.
Yes, that's a, I love that. I've not heard the unbinding before.
It came to me one day, just the unbinding.
Felicity, if somebody wants to train with you, what could they expect?
Yes, they'd come on an intro day where they'd hear lots and lots of stories about death and dying and how it really is, and learn a few very simple techniques that they could use at the bedside. And that's a great way of dipping your toe into the water and seeing if it's for you. If it's for you and you want to become a soul midwife, you would then attend a very concentrated and intense two-day course, which we're doing over Zoom still at the moment, where you would learn the theoretical aspects of the dying process and how to support people, and also the complementary, the therapeutic remedies that we use, along with safe practice and deep listening and holding space, and also how to vigil at the bedside. So there's a whole syllabus of how we best support the dying and how we become a safe pair of hands at the bedside. After that, you then would complete a 6-month probationary period where you're supported and mentored by somebody who holds your hand and takes you through working with a number of people on a voluntary basis. And after that, once you've finished and created 6 case studies, then you would become fully fledged. And increasingly, soul midwives are becoming independent practitioners within their communities. Some go on and work in hospices, but we are becoming quite a sort of an army of people on the ground who are able to go and work with people who are asking for them.
Absolutely marvelous. I love the work you've been doing all these years, and and continuing to do it, I guess, especially we're around the sacred oils. I know that's a real focus for you now.
It is. It's a real focus because it has such potency. And I think there's so much work we can be doing with them to heal people throughout many types of transition, not only death. So there's a lot of scope there.
Felicity, that's the most perfect place to end. Thank you so much for this. I've learned a lot from you today, and it's made me think, which I love doing, and it's made me think about my own death and how more determined I am to have an easier death as I possibly can, and to be conscious around it, because you're only going to have one death this lifetime. And that's a big experience, as big as you say as being born. So thank you so much. That was Felicity Warner, an inspiration for us all. For more information about soul midwives, or if you'd like further information about training to become a soul midwife, please go to www.soulmidwives.co.uk. My May guest is Patrick Leo Holland. He's an actor, a TEDx speaker, and the author of The Ultimate Power of You. Patrick believes there is a secret to life, and we all hold the answer to this secret within us. So see you on the 1st of May with Patrick, and thanks for listening. Bye for now.